Hey there, Absolution Network fans. Thomas Matt is here just to let you know that June 12th through the 14th, the Absolution Network will be at Anime Next 2015. We will be taking photos of cosplayers, we will be interviewing guests, and for you cosplayers, if you or you're part of a cosplaying group and you have a little skit, I know a lot of you group together and you have these awesome little skits, you've seen them in my videos. If you see us, let us know. We'd love to film you and put you in the Anime Next special video. But also to let you know is that we, along with John Ramos, will be doing five panels at Anime Next. John Ramos will, of course, be doing his Toku Time panel, where he covers everything Toku, including Super Sentai and Kamen Rider. And I myself will be doing four different panels. Number one, we will be having the Toonami Celebration panel, where we'll be celebrating everything Toonami. It's the third year in a row for the panel, and we do great things, and we have so much fun. We will also be having, for the second year in a row, a Tokyo SOS panel, where we will be debating who would win in a fight, as we will have sort of a tournament of champions to crown the true king of the monster. I will also be seeing the return of my American Anime Evolution of American Anime panel. I'll have the full title for you probably next time I review, where I will sort of teach about how America created anime and how there is such a thing as American anime. And last but not least, I have my Urbame panel. This is a look into how urban culture of America helped towards the acceptance and popularity of Japanese anime in America. All that and more at Anime Next 2015 at June 12th to the 14th. So I will see you at Anime Next, and enjoy the show.
Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me, I've waited long enough.
As I gaze upon the beautiful abyss of outer space, I can't help but reminisce on how we held onto our faith. Gold is how we stayed till the day that time would say that Toonami's back, bitches. Pardon my francais. Now every week the Absolution blasts off while the masses watch as an old familiar mascot by the name of Tom takes a seat and kicks the broadcast off, making major moves like a triple cut backdrop. I still remember watching that Beyond doing damage and thinking, damn, is Goku ever gonna reach Namek? Obviously I got a lot of love for the classics. The speed at which I used to run home to watch was the fastest. Absolution moving, flying through the galaxy. Toonami's back with a slap in the face to those who doubted it. Remain Toonami faithful till the day that I am graying old, and like a Super Saiyan's glow, I will always stay gold.
This is Nerdcore Absolution. Come to peace with your inner nerd, and after you can stay gold like T.O.M. Chilling out the galaxy and we know him. Putting tunes up that'll keep you up. Glued to the screen like you knew too much. The galaxy is ours, the sun and the stars. Toonami's on and chilling hard.
Watching closely from a perch among the stars, as viewers await the moment when the spirit bomb can charge. Hito Yui self.
Hey there, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your primetime host, Thomas Mattis, and this is episode 119 of The Prerogative, where this week we come back with a vengeance after a long undue hiatus. Review a 1992 movie directed by one of the greatest American animators of all time, in Ralph Bakshi, an animator we haven't talked much about. That's right, we go back to 1992, where we review the live-action animation hybrid Cool World, right here on Tom's Prerogative. So, yeah, I'm back. don't you just love these unannounced, undue hiatuses? as I've dealt with computer problems, which, as I sort of stated on a recent episode of CM Jews, which I recently released, you know, I thought I would have gotten past them when I made it out of February clean. That was a nice thought. Anyways, but, you know, I had computer problems. That's kind of put me out for a month, also while finishing up finals and all that, which I did. I'm also dealing with currently I'm transforming myself every day, as I gain knowledge, but I'm currently transferring to a new school, which has been the whole plan, as I am right now, and so I'm getting all of that out of the way, and then, of course, there's also preparations for Anime Next. Preparations just in case I do get accepted to go to Otakon and all that stuff. So, you know, I'm preparing for the summer and everything. So, I've kind of been busy and my focus has just been other places. And really, that's what it is. I've just been focused on a lot of other things and it's along with computer problems. That's what it is. But we're back with Vengeance, and as I made mention, this week on The Prerogative, we are reviewing Cool World, the infamous movie. Of course, I don't think anybody can deny it's a movie that is hugely influenced by Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It has to be. So, whether people will admit it or not. Whether Ralph Bakshi will admit it or not. And, you know, speaking of him, let's talk about him, because we really haven't reviewed anything, I think, by him on Tom's Prerogative, which I think is a crying shame. Yeah, and mind you, that part of it is due to me not having a lot of sort of, I want to say nostalgia, but I've not really had much experience with Bakshi's films, which is a crying shame. I mean, I've heard of Fritz the Cat, but I've never gotten to see Fritz the Cat. I've never gotten to see a lot of his stuff. You know, even some of his more mainstream stuff, like Fire and Ice. I think I've seen Fire and Ice once. Or, for that matter, Lord of the Rings, the animated Hobbit movie. I actually never saw it. I've seen clips of it, but I've never seen it. I believe he had something in heavy metal, so I've probably seen him there. So I've seen him bits and places here and there and everywhere. And mind you, I've of course seen clips of this film before I finally sat down to watch it. Mind you, when I watched this 2 months ago, this was the first time I actually got to sit down and watch the film. I had never seen the film since then. I had seen clips. I think I had seen, like, the dance scene and maybe, like, some of the opening or whatever, but I never got a chance to sit down and watch it. So, the plus side of that is I went in completely clean. I had no real feel for Bakshi's work. I had no real feel for this film. I had nothing for it or against it. In a way, I was kind of pure in my direction of going into Cool World. With that being said, I think it is a crying shame that we haven't done anything in Ralph Bakshi, because I do think, looking at what he's done, and mind you, in watching Cool World, I have gone on to YouTube and seen some of his other animated work. I think it is a crying shame. You know, he's an important animator in American history, one of the important. I think he does deserve to be right up there with a Chuck Jones and Tex Avery and his influence. I think his most influential aspect is not necessarily in his animation, but in the fact that he was willing to go places that other animators weren't. In particular on the sexual side, but also other dark sides and things that, you know, in general, American animators wouldn't touch, subjects they wouldn't touch. Because, again, that age ghetto that we put animation in this country, that, oh, it's animation, it has to be for kids. And he changed that. Unfortunately, the change still allows it to be in this age ghetto, but at least now it's in this sense of you know, it's either for kids or it's for adults, which is a little better. I don't think it would be till Disney, even though it's sort of returned to this, as I may mention. Though we had the point in the 90s where Disney, I think, really set the standard for, you know, animations for everyone. It can be of any, for any age, any group, any demographic. And I do think that sentiment is out there for the rest of the world. I just think in the country in particular these days, especially when you look at some of the stuff out there now. Though, it can kind of change. At the end of the day, I think it's a change for the better, no doubt, because he was really the first one to push through that barrier and that idea of animation being something other than for kids. And because of it, we do have all this stuff to where animation is targeted at certain demographics, regardless of whether my feelings for today's current seemingly targeting of the hipsters and the deconstruction of animation plots that's currently going on right now, when you see with Teen Titans Go and Gumball and Adventure Time, regardless of whether I like them or not. And by that indication, I don't, because I think everything is now a deconstruction, and personally, that's kind of pissed me off, because you can't have a deconstruction of certain plot types unless you have animation of those plot types to showcase. You know, Teen Titans Go doesn't work unless it's also partnered with Teen Titans. I really think that's the thing there. You know, it seems we have this obsession these days with deconstructing, because I think we think that it makes us look smarter. And it really doesn't. All it says is you know how a plot and how a story is built. And that's it. But I don't really want to get into too much about deconstruction. Though that does seem to be Ralph Bakshi's sort of one of his strengths, is he is able to sort of deconstruct plots, and he's able to use them to tackle dark and more adult themes. Not necessarily that all adult themes are dark, and that all dark themes are necessarily adult, though they do go hand in hand. In particular, sexism and sexuality. Use Fritz the Cat to tackle that, regardless of whether the author liked it. And, you know, that's also something I find interesting in looking on his history, is that he, again, because he's willing to go to those places and really willing to tackle those themes, he's angered, obviously, a lot of people. And kind of cruel is the proliferity of that, as we'll get into. Cruel World was directed by Ralph Bakshi. It was produced by, as I look at his name, oops, I'm on the wrong page of my notes. Excuse me, folks, I'm sorry. Frank Maniscalco Jr., I hope I'm saying that right, who created sequels to Friday the 13th and was well known for his horror. Sort of go behind the scenes of Cool World here. There was a lot of disagreement. It really started with, you know, again, 1990, Ralph pitched this to Paramount. They immediately bought it. But when they were building sets in Las Vegas and getting ready to shoot and do everything, Frank had gone behind his back and rewritten the script and changed the direction of the movie. And then the arguments just started there, which apparently included Ralph punching him in the face and included lawsuits. There's apparently a story I read of Kim Basinger thinking that she could send this show, one new film that she thought she could show to sick children in the hospital, which makes me laugh. But it's just, there was so much dysfunction with this film, and I think it showcases the fact that one of Ralph Bakshi's strengths, his ability to want to tackle those dark themes, and his willingness to tackle those adult themes, is also his weakness. As many times, person's greatest strength sometimes is also their greatest weakness. And in this case, I think it's pride to want to stay and tackle those themes. And, I mean, understandably, he is an artist. And most artists are like that. But that is one of the weaknesses of the films. Not that I'm saying that Frank Muschi Jr. is at all no fault. He is absolutely fault. He is the instigator. And I get the feeling from what I've read that he wanted no part of this project. Really whatsoever. I mean, it's even indicated from what I've read that part of the reason he did what he did is because he wanted to get away from doing horror. And the original idea for this film was that, you know, it was supposed to be a horror film where, you know, a male from the real world and a female from the cartoon world had sex, had a hybrid child, and the hybrid child comes to the real world and is murdering people as she's trying to get revenge on her father. It's supposed to be a murder thriller type of thing. Which I thought, in seeing that concept, that would have been just, yeah, it would have been really interesting to see. And frankly, I would have loved to have seen Ralph's original idea get put into motion. But at the same point in time, I don't think this film was non-savable. You know, we'll talk more about this when we get into the review, but again, pride came into part, and as we'll see when we review the film, if they could have just worked together, I think there was something there that they could have produced. Yeah, because again, animation is built on teamwork. I think Walt Disney's animation showed that, particularly in the 90s. But anyways, Cool World, the first Rossowski film, definitely I look forward to in the future, maybe reviewing some more. But I am really kind of proud that we're going to finally review a Ralph Bowski film, and goddammit, I've been talking for over 13 minutes. So, why would you say we get on with the review, shall we? So, ladies and gentlemen, Cool World, it takes place in 1992, where incarcerated cartoonist Jack Deebs is getting ready to get out of prison for murdering a man that he found in bed with his wife. While in prison, he created this world called Cool World, featuring the femme fatale, Holly Wood. As he gets out of prison, he's pulled into Cool World by Holly Wood, who just wants to have sex with him. Ow. While there, he also meets Detective Frank Harris, a World War II veteran who had been pulled into the cartoon world in 1945 when, after returning from the war, him and his mother had been struck by drunk drivers, killing her and severely injuring him. Frank tells Jack, you can't have sex with Holly. It's against the law, and it will cause bad things. So, does Jack Deep succumb to the advances of the sexual Hollywood? Or does Detective Frank Harris stop these bad things from happening? We'll find that out and more as we review Cool World. Welcome back, and let's get right into it as we do. And let's talk about score. And by score, I mean score and sort of the soundtrack, because, again, we're not reviewing a musical, so we don't have any songs to talk about. So in general, it's just the score. The music itself was done by Mark Ingram, or Isham, excuse me, who's contributed to a lot of soundtracks throughout the years, including Fly Away Home, Varsity Blues, just to name a few. So he did the overall score, which sounded fine. And then, of course, you had, if you look at the soundtrack, there's a lot of songs contributed by artists like David Bowie, Thompson Twins, which you just heard, Electronica, and some other sort of, a mixture of sort of techno and house and sort of heavy metal bands as well. All integrated, I thought, really well into the score. The parts of the score that I really, really enjoyed were the techno and house, because it sort of gave it that sort of gritty 90s feel to the movie that definitely was of age. And that had a nostalgic feel to me. It kind of was that sort of same type of music that, you know, I was instantly actually being brought to Macross Plus in a way, that sort of techno house pop type of thing. Though this is a bit more gritty than that, but just that sort of electronic seduction that was in techno and house that really brought me into the scenes. And those scenes that had that type of music, I thought really, really fit the movie. And the other ones fit the movie as well. In particular with, when Brad Pitt's character, again, not that I made mention of all the actors who were in this. I mean, you have Brad Pitt, Kim Basinger voicing Hollywood and playing her live action part. Of course, those being the two big ones. But, you know, when Harris's character, or Frank Harris, with Loretta, Lynetta, excuse me, I apologize, the sort of more sort of jazz part of it, and sort of fits that World War II theme, fits there as well. And it is a really nice touch and a really nice, different side of the soundtrack that really fits the film and gives it some contrast. And the score part of the film and the live action parts, though, I don't think fit real well. I mean, in the beginning parts where Jack D's, like, for instance, when he's in the comic book store and everything, that fits, but mostly I'm talking about when they come back from Cool World, when Holly has become human. Those parts I don't think really fit. Mind you, that whole part of the film, and this is going to be a common thing you'll hear throughout this review, the film really changed after Hollywood became human. And from there on, the film itself was really a mess. And I need to bring that up because you're going to hear me talking a lot about, the first half of the film. The first part was good. The second half of the film was bad. And that's a common thing you're going to be hearing me say. So, overall, I really enjoyed most of the score. Like I said, the parts in the second half in the live action world, really not good, but that first half in particular, the techno and the house part, that just has this real 90s gritty feel to it. It's like, oh, it just has such nostalgic feelings for me as well, and I think that taints my view as well. Obviously, I'm somebody who grew up in the 90s, and I remember that feel, and I just love that sound. So somebody who wasn't from that time, in particular somebody born in the 2000s and onward, may not really understand that sound and not like it. So I think that's also something that's going to be determined on the taste of the person. But, yeah. It really is something to where I think overall it really fits the film and does work with the film really, really well. With that, let's move on to animation. And so, in general, we're talking about the animation scenes and everything, because this is an animation live-action hybrid like Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Though in this case, it's more of humans being in a cartoon world. We'll kind of get to that when we get to acting, or we'll get to that to special effects as well. But, really not pulled off as well as Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Though, I'll sit here and say this. I don't think it has anything to do with either Gabriel Byrne's or Brad Pitt's performance. But we'll get to their performance when we get to acting as well. But the animation, I really love the animation. You can just feel the influence of both the Fleischer style and the Teletoons styles, where, you know, Ralph Bakshi first worked was in Teletoons. You can see the influence of it by him and his, you know, animators of those studios in the animation here. It's just wonderful. It's probably, of what I've seen of Ralph Bakshi, it's his best work yet. Just that really sort of classic 1950s cartoon style, bright colors. But I'm going to create a word here. It's grittified. Because it, you know, you'll have all those colors and different colors, yet it's darkened. It's made to feel gritty, and it really works within the film. You know, because, like, for instance, even the white feels dirty. And that's really, really just fantastic. I'm searching for the words here to really describe it. But it's like, I think this is one of the things that Ralph Bakshi does so well within his animation, is that he understands twerking the color palettes just a little bit to sort of fit sort of themes that he wants to play with. And in this case, making those colors, even when they're bright, just a bit gritty, where there's a darkened aspect even to the white, and you have, for instance, you have Hollywood, who's in white, that a lot of times represents purity, but there's a darkness, there's a sort of dark aura to that white that, you know, gives her that sinister feel to her that really makes that character shine out. And then going into character designs, hey, Donovan Morgan Grant, I'm sure this is going to surprise you, nor a lot of people, but I really like Hollywood's design. Wait, Thomas likes the design of a very hypersexual character? Why do you have to use hypersexual? Now you're sending Don into a tizzy. Wonderful. Damn it. God damn it. You had to use hypersexual, didn't you? As I talk with myself. But you know what? For what the movie was attempting to go for, and this is kind of the context we have to put this in reviewing this movie, because we'll get to the fact that this movie failed. But in the context of what it was going for, the character design of Hollywood, that sort of early 1990s gritty sort of sexual femme fatale type of girl that wants to have fun, it fits so well. It was perfectly designed. The white along with the blonde hair, that sort of classic Americana look, and yet the dark aura around her that made her just feel sinister. Every time she was on screen, there was a sinister feel around her. And again, you can definitely feel the vibes of the original storyline within her design. And it's like, wow, that original story would have worked so well if they had done it with this character design. But alas. And obviously, there's definitely an influence of Jessica Rabbit here. This is why I made mention of this earlier, and I'm not sitting here and saying that Ralph Bakshi ripped off Disney and I want to say Jack. I don't know why I want to say Jack Williams. I'm blanking on his name, and I can't believe I'm blanking on his name. Because he worked on things like Droopy and everything, and I apologize. But, yeah, the sex appeal that's part of Holly's character is definitely, you can feel the influence of Who Framed Roger Rabbit. A lot of people don't talk about being influenced by Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and I find that really sad, because there's a lot of things that are influenced by Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Not just to mention, you know, Space Jam and Cool World here, which are obviously influenced by them. I definitely feel a lot of the uptick in sort of the noir sort of films, those sort of detective mystery films. There's definitely a return to that in the early 90s, and I kind of attribute that to Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because, of course, we forget Who Framed Roger Rabbit was a fantastic sort of detective noir story as well. But in this regard here, Jessica Rabbit was just this fantastic femme fatale design, and you sort of see the influence there within Hollywood's design. That definitely that seductive femme fatale feel. But again, Ralph Bowski doing it to his own style as well. So while the influence is there, it's not a ripoff in my mind. Because ripping something off means taking the exact same thing and putting it in there. Being influenced means you're influenced by something and it has that feel, but it's different. It's made unique. It's made to where it feels like you. Perfect example. We had the recent music case where Robin Thicke's song that he did with Pharrell. I'm completely blanking on the name of the song. And I apologize. But basically, you know, was sued by the estate of Marvin Gaye. They said it matched a Marvin Gaye song. And while it definitely had that feel, again, you have to go back to, you know, it being an homage to something that Pharrell said, you know, wanting to have that same feel. That doesn't mean that it's ripping off. Unfortunately, jurors did not find it that way, which I think is very sad and was the wrong conclusion to come to. But again, jurors most likely aren't going to be well versed in the arts. Again, I don't want to turn this into talking about legal cases, but I'm using it as an example. I'll talk about how you can be influenced by the feel of something and use that feel and yet still make it your own. And I definitely think with Hollywood's character, Ralph Bowski made the design his own. And the other animation designs, you know, there are characters I like, you know, Dr. Vincent Vegas Vinny, Whiskers, Nails, just to name a few. I thought they were well designed. The sort of Hollywood's gang, I thought, for the most part, was really well designed. And just that, and the only problem I have with it is, why would this gang be with Hollywood? And that's something that's really, again, there are things that are really left unattended to in this film. And one of them is, why would Holly be with this gang? And again, maybe it's, I know there's a prequel comic with DC, but in the movie, for anybody who's just coming to this movie, they're really not given any reason why Holly hangs out with these goons that seem like there's no reason why she'd be with them. But yeah. My main problem with the overall animation and character designs is there just seems to be a mishmash of cartoon characters, and there seems to be no set idea to really what Cool World is about. Like, Cool World, they could have made it mostly wolves and, you know, sort of those classic sort of human characters, but then you got, like, knives going throughout the screen and wacky things happening, like, out of nowhere, and I know that Rostowski told his animators, in particular Duranger, not through anger, but like just do what feels funny. But there's just too much chaos on screen sometimes, and that's something that really hurts the overall animation, some of the character designs, is that, you know, you have all these non-living things that are alive and fighting and everything, and just things that happen out of nowhere. See, you know, it's like we're seeing in the transition to another scene, you're seeing a cat walk across the street and get hit by a safe, and then a boat, and a car, and then a plane. So it's like, there really seems to be no rhyme and reason for that. Other than, it's funny animation. And it's funny animation if you were doing a cartoon where that would make sense. Again, when that type of stuff is done in Looney Tunes, it's in regards to a story. It's a joke that is set up. Just seeing a cat hit with a safe and a car and a boat and a plane, one right after the other, with no rhyme or reason, is just like, huh? Why? And what reason does it have to do with Holly's story? But those are sort of the bad action animation that's happening, which is really crying shame because there is some fantastic action animation. In particular, the chase scene to where, you know, Holly is, and her, her gang is running from the Po-Po. And that scene to where they're running all around, it's just, there's this fantastic movement and everything. Another good action scene is, that's really funny, is when her gang is like determined to watch her basically have sex with Jack Deems, and they're like just throwing stuff on top of each other. That was fantastically done. And then sort of like the club scenes in there, Holly's dancing and everything, and Holly's movements, I'll also throw into there, really, really well done. And that's, I think, the overall thing I can say about this animation is that when they decide to stay focused on one character, one group of characters, or one particular scene, it works extremely, extremely well. For me, the big problem is when, you know, they seem to lose focus and they're doing, like I said, they're doing all these chaotic things. That really hurts it. The backgrounds are, again, a mixed thing, because here in special effects, we'll talk about the mix of live action animation. The animated backgrounds are gorgeous. They're crazy. They're chaos. They're Ralph Bowski. Of what I've seen of his style. And by the way, if I have not mentioned it, if I'm mispronouncing his name, I apologize. You know, in the research that I've done, there really hasn't been sort of a pronunciation of his name. So how I've seen other names like that done, I'm only guessing that it's pronounced Bowski. It may be Bowski. If I'm mispronouncing it, I apologize. I'm sure somebody will send me an email telling me how much of a horrible person I am. Again, I'm going off the research I've been able to find. Also, I'm going off of what I've sort of heard in some of the reviews of how it's pronounced. So, if I'm mispronouncing that, I apologize. But back on to backgrounds and special effects. But the backgrounds, like, are really Bowski's backgrounds. They really shine through just that 1950s cartoon style that he was going for with this movie fits really well. Where the backgrounds don't stand out, though, is in conjunction with the special effects. I really don't like the flatness when they go into live action. You know, when they're in the cartoon world, what they do is they like then automatically transfer to these cartoon-like sets. For instance, like, so he gets out of a car, then he walks between the cars, and you can see the cars are, like, two-dimensional. And I don't think that's aged well. It's, the problem is, that when, again, you look at Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and let's be honest, people are going to be comparing the two. Who Framed Roger Rabbit had a 3D effect to it. You know, for instance, you get out of the cab and you go around and it looks like it's in a three-dimensional space. This kind of felt cheap in a way. And I think it hurts the film. And again, the animation is beautiful, but like, it's a very jarring effect is what the problem is. Because all of a sudden you're in animation, all of a sudden, wow, I'm really on a set. And you can tell you're on a set. And even though you have animations flying, and then that's the other thing about the animation is, here you have all this chaotic animation happening and that's meant to distract you from the idea that he's on a set. But you can tell he's on a set because of the 2D feel of lampposts and things like that, and because they're not rounded. It really does hurt the film. This is what really hurts the sort of conjunction of live-action animation here, is that 2D feel to it, to where you go around the core and it's the corner is not rounded, it's flat, you can tell it's like a cardboard cutout or whatever it is, and it jars you into this reality that I'm on a set, which is really, really, you know, there are scenes to where, you know, cartoon and live action mixing, like Lynetta's room or apartment, and the chair is 3D. Like, it turns around, you can see it's a chair. That's wonderful. That's great connection there between the live action. And again, we'll get into sort of live, the actors' interaction with the animation in acting. But as far as the background's conjunction with them, it just, because of those 2D flats, it jars you into live action way too much. But overall, I actually love the animated backgrounds. And overall, despite my issues with the animation, it's very good. You know, the animation that's good is very good. And it's just, that's the thing about this animation. It's either very good or it just really, really misses the mark. The animation had so much potential to it. It's, I think, another thing to it. There's so much potential with this animation, and then just decisions like, for instance, the flat backgrounds. I may mention the flat sort of items like cars and that stuff that jar you into the thing that's a set. The animation that's there for just no rhyme and reason other than to maybe distract you from the fact that you're now on a set. Or just because, hey, we're going to put this funny thing to where this being gets hit by multiple things for no rhyme and reason that has any conjunction with the movie whatsoever other than, hey, it looks funny. And it makes it feel chaotic, but in the wrong way. And it's like, it's wasted potential. But the potential that's focused on, and that's the thing, is the stuff to where they sit down and they focus on it. Like Holly's design, for instance. It's knocked out of the park. We're going to be talking a lot more about potential after the break, because we're going to get into acting and, God help us, we're going to get into story. So I'm going to take a quick break, folks. And when we come back, like I said, we're going to get into acting and the story, so I'll be right back. After these messages, we'll be
right back. Superman.
Captain Marvel.
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds Will Live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds Will Die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Arion.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear
Man. The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at TwoTrueFreaks.com.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
Greetings, podcast listener. Do you like...
Gatchaman!
Or maybe...
Dragon Slay!
How about...
Tatsuo! Ganeda!
Or...
In the year 1999, an abandoned alien battle fortress crash-landed on the planet Earth. Our most brilliant scientists and engineers spent the next 10 years reconstructing the damaged ship and studying its highly advanced space technology called Robotech.
Do you remember...
Our Star Blazers!
Or this?
The year is after Colony 195. As the world constantly changes in the chaotic era, there are two mobile suits that could turn humans into the ultimate weapon. The Wing Zero, and the Epion.
Or maybe even this.
After the desire for blood rules all, the only hope left is the one they call D.
Or this.
Gene, grappler ship's dead ahead!
It wouldn't be fun otherwise! Let's do it!
Or...
If Cardis is allowed to be reborn, she'll destroy Marmo as well as Lodos!
Or have you seen the latest episode of...
And just like that, everything changed. At that terrible moment, in our hearts, we knew. Home was a pen. Humanity, cattle.
If you answered yes to any of these questions, then you should check out Anime Freaks, hosted by Dr. Bill Robinson and me, Gene Hendricks. Anime Freaks is a monthly podcast covering all things anime. It is available at TwoTrueFreaks.com. And on iTunes under Two True Freaks Presents Anime Freaks.
Hey everyone, my name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not... bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Hey
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986
and Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
And welcome back, and let's get right back into it with acting, which means it's time to go over our cast list. We have Brad Pitt, very young in his career, as Detective Frank Harris. Kim, as the irredeemable Shag once said on Michael Bailey's podcast, after 9.5 weeks, everybody wanted to bang her. Basinger, as Hollywood. Gabriel Byrne, as Jack Debs. Candy Milo, as Lonetta. Charles Adler as Nails, along with a couple of others. Maurice Lamouche, Div, legendary, you know, the brain himself, as Interrogator Number 2, MASH, Dr. Vincent, Vinny Vegas, Whiskers, and Super Jack Debs. Or Debs, excuse me. And numerous other voice actors. You've had to, like, go down. Some of the others include George Sninoff, Patrick Penny, Michael Lally, Joe Carmen, and of course, we cannot forget Frank Wechsler as the telephone that, you know, tried to, you know, get to, you know, Frank. because, you know, it's Frank. He's in everything. I'm laughing because I recently watched an episode of a wonderful review show called Brandon's sort of cult movie reviews. It's on YouTube. He's also a part of Channel Awesome right now, and he once reviewed one of the animated movies that came out after the popularity of Fritz the Cat, called Once Upon a Time, a Pornographic Fairy Tale Story, that apparently Frank Wechsler was a part of. He voiced several characters. And so that's why I laughed. I was like, God damn it, Frank was in everything. When Scott McNeil made the joke about, you know, the bird and Frank, he wasn't lying. But on to acting, we'll start with our protagonist. I thought Brad Pitt did a really good job. I mean, he didn't do as good of a job as, you know, Bob Hoskins. But I mean, Bob Hoskins is an amazing actor. Not that Brad Pitt isn't, but I think Bob Hoskins is a better actor than Brad Pitt personally. And it's not a matter of Brad Pitt's awful and is like godly. It's a matter of, I just think in the roles that I've seen them in, I think Hopkins is overall better actor than Brad Pitt. I think he's more in character personally. And I just think there's this very, there's a charisma about his acting that's better than Brad Pitt. Whereas Brad Pitt, a lot of times when I see him act, he's a bit monotone. And this is one of those instances where overall he's just a bit monotone. There isn't much to his character through his acting. It's really well performed and he plays the character tremendously well, but it's a very monotone performance. But overall, I thought he did well, and I thought he acted extremely well with the animation. Again, I think Hopkins did it better, but then again, also I think that has more to do with he's given more opportunities to do it better, because Who Framed Roger Rabbit really went outside the box with how they had animation and live action interact, in particular in the fact that most of it took place in a real world, as opposed to here, where they had the balance of a animation world to fall back onto. Gabriel Byrne, who's sort of in a gray area, kind of an antagonist, but really is a protagonist. He's sort of a victim here. I thought he did extremely well as this animator, this cartoonist trying to find his life, being pulled into this world that he thinks he created and everything. So I thought he did an overall really good job of just this very confused character. Unfortunately, I think the bigger part of the problem is that they really don't do much with his character. Again, we'll get into this story. But as far as what he was acting as, he did a terrific job acting. And again, really acted really well with the animation. You really thought like him and the animation was there. So really well done. And then the other characters, you know, Candace Mello as Lynetta, I thought her voice work here was really well done and really helped you connect with the character. You had some sympathetic for this character who's just in love with Detective Harris. But of course they can't interact because it's forbidden for cartoons and humans to interact. Something that I wish they would have touched on more, because I think there was something there. And again, I think we'll get into that with themes and story and everything. That's really the hard part to talk about some of these performances. Is the performances are good. Again, it's the story that really hurts them. So her performance is good, and of course you had the other voice actors, Charles Adler, Maurice Lennart, again, really well done. Antagonist, obviously, we're talking about Kim Basinger. Just, again, I made the joke in when, you know, announcing her name in the cast list of the irredeemable one himself, the irredeemable Shag, who you can find, you know, his blog, the Fire and Water podcast, which looks at Firestorm and Aquaman, fireandwaterpodcast.blogspot.com, where he does a wonderful podcast. But it was one of the things in doing the notes, it's like that for a reason just kept popping into my mind of why they picked Kim Basinger, because this was after 9.5 weeks, which is a erotic charge movie. I mean, it's also after Batman, where she played Vicky Vale, after she played a Bond girl. So after all that stuff, it was Kim Basinger in the early 90s. Everybody wanted to bang her. And that just thought by the Irredeemable One just kept popping into my mind. but I thought she did a really great job. I thought acting in both parts. I thought she did terrific voice work. I absolutely believed in the sort of sinister nature of Hollywood. I don't think this is a matter of how many names we can get on the box, because I thought she fit it perfectly. With that being said, my only reason I kind of have a problem with her live action acting is only because it's just very predictable. And by predictable, I mean, again, it's story. And it's like, it's the same tired old shtick, you know, the cartoon from another world comes out and interacts with the real world and it's completely different. For a reason, I just kind of feel embarrassed by it. It's like, we're really going down this path. We really have to do this. You know, with somebody who was supposed to be as enamored with the real world as she was, you would think she would have a better concept of the real world and how it works. I thought she did a really good job as the antagonist. I mean, it's just this femme fatale who was going to do things her way, and she wasn't going to take anything from her. In that case, Hollywood could have been a really good, strong female character. Again, it's just unfortunate the story was crap. Whereas Jessica Rabbit sort of stood for something and stood up for herself, defended herself, here you have a character that talks about standing up for herself, talks about not taking no crap, and does it, but kind of doesn't. Again, comparing the two characters, but again, this goes to story, and I think that's a perfect segue into a story, because really the biggest fault of this film is its story. This is where so much wasted potential happened, and really, again, it goes back to what I talked about in the beginning when I talked about sort of the behind the scenes of this movie. You know, I talked about the differences of opinions between the producer and the director here, and just how they clashed, and really how Bosky went his own way with the animation and then directed it their way, and you have these two conflicting ideas of what they wanted the movie to be. And instead of sitting down like, okay, here's what you want to do, here's what I want to do, how do we make this work? You know, it's, I'm going to do what I do, you do what you do. And you had these two conflicting ideas conflicting and just clashing, and we got the story we got. It starts with the plot. The plot started off really well. The idea of this cartoon being enamored with the real world, wanting to get to the real world. But again, then she gets, again, when they have her change human, that's where the plot starts to fall apart, because the plot then becomes about how, well, she's a cartoon in the real world, so it's interrupting the balances of the world. And that didn't really need to be there. That's really where the problem with that whole, the interaction in her, at her conflicting, you know, to where she thought the real world was this way, and all that, those funny gags, you know, where she dances and sings in the bar and everything. That's why that falls apart. And the whole thing to where she unleashes the demons of the cartoon world to descend and take over the live-action world. It's like, really? Really? I mean, I don't know if this was part of Bowski's, I mean, if it was, then maybe I need to start taking back stuff I've been saying about his original concept. But I have a hard time imagining this was a part of his original concept, because it's stupid. The idea that there's this different world and it's going to take over this other world because this one thing was taken off, the cap was taken off. And it's like, really? It turns from a plot about a character trying to be something she isn't into a, oh my god, we have to save the world. And it's like, what plot do you want to go to? It's like, this isn't the plot we've been following for most of the movie, and now we're thrown into this, we have to save the world plot. And it's like, it's such wasted potential. And again, you're invested in this story about Hollywood. Again, I call her an antagonist, but she's more of a sort of, and I was going to say not lonely hero, but she's more of a tragic character than she is an antagonist. Well, mind you, there's a lot of tragic characters as antagonists, so that's sort of the wrong way to put it, but what I'm saying is, rather than looking at her as a bad guy, you look at her more as this tragic character who's going down this road of doom that you know is going to be doomed for her. And you know she's going to end up crushed, or dreams crushed, or whatever, possibly dead. And it's sad to see it happen, but she's continuing down this road. And that's just seemingly thrown out the window once she becomes human. And it becomes this plot of, like, well, she became human, and now she, her real goal is that she wants to have the cartoon world take over the human world. It's like, this is really necessary? We really needed to turn this into that plot? It couldn't just be about how the fact that, you know, cartoon can't exist in the live world? Again, a theme that they could have tackled that I really think they didn't. And that's a great segue into the other point, which is there is no theme here. You know, Mabowski is focused a lot of times on sexual attitude and everything. There's no really theme that connects that sexual attitude that's happening on the screen. And I'm watching this movie and I saw several themes they could have used. As I made mention, the whole idea of, you know, fiction and reality, of Hollywood representing this idea of, you know, we're enamored by fictional characters, but we have to understand that fictional characters are just that, fiction. They don't exist in the real world. And we can't treat the real world as if we can be these fictional characters. He could have tackled that. He didn't. I think there is a theme there that could have been tackled upon the sexual forbidden, and why is it forbidden, with the whole concept of, you know, why toons and humans can't have sex. He didn't. Probably more than likely due to the fact that it was PG-13, and they probably shut that down, but still, that's something that could have been covered. Themes of, you know, it just didn't seem to be any theme to connect and give rhyme or reason to why the plot did what it did. There seemed to be inklings, like, I can see it going down this thematic road, but it never goes down that thematic road. And that really hurt. And that, again, that's a great prime example of how this is just a film of two conflicting, clashing ideas between the producer and the director here. Another example of that is the character plots. Really, the only character plots that sort of come, that evolve to a logical point and logical satisfying point is Harris and Lynetta's sort of plot. That whole, you know, these two characters who are in love, but they can't be in love. But, you know, when he gets killed by Hollywood, who's a toon, he then becomes a toon, which, that's really a strange thing to just pop out of nowhere, because you don't know that rule. That's like a rule. That rule just comes out of nowhere. It comes directly at the end. You have no inkling that that rule exists. And this film, if that was going to be a rule and he had all these rules about how toons and humans interact, it's one of the things that really could have helped the, and then again, going back into themes of, like, here's this rules of how toons and humans can interact together. You can't do this because of this. And if this happens, this happens. And so on, so on, and so on. But you're really never given any inkling of that, and that hurts the film. But, you know, again, to where, you know, he's killed, but he comes back to life, and now he's a toon, and now they can have all the sex they want, and the house goes bump ba da bump da bump da bump ba da bump 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 bop chicka bow bow. And again, not because they're having sex, but again, Lynetta, you know, again, the acting by both, and you really connected with these characters, and that they were really in love. And again, there's a theme there that could have been tackled about our cartoons being our fantasies. Again, going to that whole different, they are fiction. But again, you know, Leonetta's design, I didn't talk about that, and I really should have, because I thought it was a great idea of, again, you know, sort of his connection with the mother, and so the girl of his dreams would be someone like his mother because of how much he cared for his mother. And that's really not touched on at all. And it's obviously there, but it's not touched on. And why isn't it touched on? It's like, it's such a missed opportunity. You know, you have Jack Deebson. Why was he put in prison? Really never touched on. Why he connects with Hollywood so much. It's not just because she's a femme fatale. Again, possibly Hollywood looks like his former lover. Not connected on. Why Dr. Whiskers was in Vegas. Not connected. It's like all these stereo points and character plots and character points never touched on. And understandably, it's a movie and has limited time. But again, I think if you take out some of these animation shots and you take out this whole big chase scene, I mean, you can take out that whole bar scene, you can take out a lot of things and put different scenes in and tackle some of those character points and not be so much focused on just chaos and funny animation. Again, as much as I'd like to put all the blame here on Mastriano Jr. for just, like, overriding and doing what he wants, some has to be put on, sort of, I think, the pride as an artist for Rowski for not coming down, letting his pride go and saying, like, how do I make this work? How do I make this work? Here's how the story goes. Because, again, if you look at some of his other work, he does this. So it's like character plot and character point not really touched upon. It all leads to just the fact that the whole story, in particular, after Hollywood becomes human, just becomes an absolute mess. And there's so many plot points left really untouched. Things happen out of nowhere, and if you're told at all why, it's this rule that you never knew existed. And by the end of the movie, you just feel lost. And the whole ending of, you know, well, the both couples end up together, and now Jack uses a cartoon, too, and he's Super Jack Deebs, and him and Holly are this super couple, and they're gonna build this house in this nice little desert, and Hollywood's like, oh, fuck me. It's just, huh? What did I just watch? No, seriously, what the hell did I just watch? I mean, another part of it is, I do understand that maybe Vegas hasn't changed that much since World War II, since 1992, but the fact of the matter is, Detective Frank Harris hasn't been in the real world since 1945. I think there would be a bit more culture shock to him, considering how the world has changed from 1945 to 1992. Just a tad bit. These are stuff they could have tackled and could have made the film better, and they didn't. It's like, this film had so much potential. So much. I mean, even if it's PG-13, here's what you do. You take it, and you make the film about how we have, again, as I made mention, about one of the themes they could have tackled. Make it about how we can't allow ourselves to be succumbed by the attraction of fantasy being real. We have to understand that we live in the real world, and there are real consequences and real problems that affect us, and we can't just escape to fantasy worlds and run away from them. We have to, again, that he murdered the man, and he had to face up that his own problems probably caused his wife to sleep with the man. And so there's so much they could have done. Now, just the original plot idea of Ralph Bowski, as amazing as that probably could have been, and I would love to see it, at the same point in time, there's other things, and the production team could have worked together to make this film better. But as such, this is, and I may mention this probably on Facebook before, a couple, 2 months ago when I originally saw it, this film is the most, has the most wasted potential I've ever seen. There's so much potential, and yet it's so wasted in this film. And as I've been mentioning, you can point to the conflict between the production team and the director and everything, and yet it's good at explaining it. It still doesn't change the fact that this is not a good film because there's so much wasted potential, and yet the story is not focused on, and there's no plot development, there's no concrete plot, there's two different plots that are approached, one in the first half and the other in the second half. There's no concrete theme. An individual character plot and plot points happen for no rhyme and reason, with only one following through to its concrete logical conclusion. But it does so through a plot point that comes out of nowhere that you don't know about. And the audience, I think, through most of this movie, in particular in that second half, is just left confused. And it's, this movie could have been so much more. And it's really sad in its own way to watch this movie and realize this movie could be so much more. They had so much working with it. It was so good. There's so much there, and it's like you want to throw your hands through the television screen and grab the director, like, no, no, do this, do this. But it's so wasted. So at the end of the day, there's a lot of really good animation, at least the ones that are focused on the story. There's a really, really decent score that has sort of a nostalgic 90s feel to it. The acting, while not great, is good. Some it might just be serviceable, but I thought was really well done, while not great. But the story is just a mess. I would almost be willing to say that, kind of like Godzilla vs. Megalon, this is one of those movies where you really should only watch it to a certain point, or start at a certain point and watch it, you know. Whereas, unlike Godzilla vs. Megalon, I feel you should start it, like, once the monster fight, and really, that final monster fight's all that's worth watching. I think this film, in a way, is only worth watching up to the point to where Holly has sex, and just say, well, Holly won, and Holly became human, and they lived off and lived happily ever after, and just end the movie there. Because the rest of the story, because that's a whole lot better than what the rest of the story really is. Just a lot of wasted potential with the story that really, really hurts the film. A film that had so much potential. So I give Cool World a 2 out of 5. I do think it is worth watching because I think it's worth watching to see what not to do with story and how conflict between director and production team and everything can hurt the story. How conflict can ruin potential. I think it's also worth watching if you're a fan of Ralph Bowski. If you're a fan of live-action animated movies. Because there's not many of them, and they're all worth watching. I mean, I'm talking about story. This film, to an extent, is serviceable as a watch. And there's a lot of cool stuff in it to see. And it's worth watching, I think, at least once. To see if it's something you like or would watch again. And certainly, I'll probably watch that first part, the first half of the movie, again at some point. But definitely, this is not a good movie. by any means, it's not. And really, the sad part about it is, I mean, there are movies that aren't good, but because, you know, it's, you know, they're just not good, and it's like they missed the mark, and it's this, this, and this. But then there are movies that could have been good. You know, remember, I talk about this Frozen, whereas Frozen is a good movie that could have been great, this is a bad movie that could have been good. So just so much wasted potential. 2 out of 5 for me for Cool World. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, there are several ways to contact the show. If you have any comments on this review or any other review I do, one, you can email us at appsolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's appsolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on our Stitcher account, which you can find at www.stitcher.com, and search for the Appsolution Network. Like us, bookmark our podcast, and leave us comments. You can also leave us comments on our Facebook page, which you can find by going to Facebook and searching for the Appsolution Network. I think there's another page called the Appsolution Network where the one with the A and the N logo. Like us, leave us a comment there. And of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Also, while you're there, make sure you check out all the other 132 Productions content. This, of course, includes my CMG's wrestling reviews, the Anthropographic Review, which will have a podcast out next week, as soon as I put it all together. Hopefully, I'll have it out next week. I'll have, hopefully, a new podcast actually premiering sometime next week as well, around D&D and other things. Whenever I get to it, I'll try to also restart Tom's Top 10. Then, of course, there's also the other members of the Appsolution Network, which you check out. Of course, Relic and the Anticast, the Otaku Momentum, Shooting Tiger Curl and his wrestling, and Let's Play video game videos, and John Romanson and his Toku videos. And while we're, by the way, on the subject of the Appsolution Network, me and John Ramos will be at Anime Next June 11th to the 13th, I believe it is. And yes, that could be the 12th to the 14th, where we'll be doing panels and we will be taking photos. If you have a great cosplay, or you and your group have a great cosplay, have a great little skit, and you see us, let us know. We'll film you and we'll put you in the video for the Appsolution Network Anime Next special. Of course, we'll be interviewing guests as well. So we're going to be there, and we have five great panels to debut. And of course, the other sites that are part of 132 Productions, that of course includes Comic Book Crazy, featuring the old Comic Book Crazy podcast, Hexcast, and Spectacular Webs. You can find that at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And of course, Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And of course, at any of these sites, check out our sidebar to find out all our friends. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey and Yushin Lombox, Spidey Dude and the Clone Saga Chronicles, Steven Schleicher and the Critical Hit Podcast, and of course, Scott Gardner and the Two True Freaks Podcasting Network. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Appsolution Network. I hope you enjoyed this review. I had a lot of fun reviewing today. I'm starting to get back into the flow. So if I seemed a little disjointed, I apologize. But I'm trying to get back into the flow as it is, as I prepare for things. And next week, well, we continue the fan service fest, because I don't think, let's make any bones about it, there's a lot of fan service in this film. A lot of sexual fan service. And you know how I like my sexual fan service. Well, speaking of that, we're going to review a movie based off a video game next week. which has a lot of fan service. As next week, we review Bayonetta,
long enough.
Bloody Fate. So until next time, my Toonami generation, stay golden.
Whenever you're ready. Welcome to the televised revolution. As we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution, with time back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place. If you have a taste for animation in deep space base, broadcast through your television. Due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission, the same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to show when Action Tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary. The other king of television besides Mary, full of new shows and classics on the itinerary.
Well, that about does her. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom, signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.